Brad Crandall here. Coming up now, a special monitor feature. Highlights of the first annual Washington Baseball Writers' Dinner, given earlier this past week. Toastmaster Joe Garagiola presided. First words are from the dinner chairman, Maury Siegel.
Dick Williams, the manager of those miraculous Red Sox, noticed President Johnson, who has a few problems of his own, looked particularly worried. And Dick, in a wonderful attempt to mollify the president, said, "Mr. President, I know exactly how you feel. Back in April, I was 100-to-1 shot myself."
The speaker was Maury Siegel of the Washington Star. Maury was the dinner chairman for the first annual dinner of the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Baseball Writers Association of America. The dinner was held last Tuesday night, and I've gone on record that it's the most unusual sports banquet I've ever attended. I was fortunate enough to be asked to serve as Toastmaster, and I really enjoyed it. At the risk of seeming immodest, I'd like to take just a minute or so to let you hear some of the nice things that were said about me. In his introduction of me, Maury Siegel was kind enough to say,
"Ladies and gentlemen, our Toastmaster tonight, Joe Garagiola, as you probably know, is a self-made man. That shows the evils of unskilled labor."
You'd figure that if there was one group of people in the world who'd go out of their way to be nice to me, it would be pitchers. One of the honored guests was an ex-Senator pitcher who had such a fine season last year for the San Francisco Giants, Mike McCormick. And I'm glad this is radio so you can't see me blush.
"You know, I've known Joe a long time, and having been an old Giant, which I am also, you talk about your hitting, you criticize your hitting, but what these people don't realize is that Joe is one of the few ball players, when he went home in the winter, he soaked his hands in motor oil so they wouldn't rust."
It wasn't just the newspaper men and the pitchers who said nice things about me. The press secretary to the First Lady, Mrs. Liz Carpenter, explained to the audience that she hadn't known much about sports when she had been invited to speak.
"But I was game. And I called in the experts like Maury Siegel and Joe Garagiola. And as it so happened, they turned out to be pretty gamey themselves."
Well, catchers always have problems. The fine young catcher of the Washington Club, Paul Casanova, was honored as the most popular man on the team by a vote of the fans. On a ball field, Casanova is a problem to the other team. But on a dais, he has a problem of his own. A native of Cuba, Casanova won the crowd completely with his acceptance speech.
"Actually, I really don't have much to say about this because I really feel that this trophy not only belongs to me, but it belongs to all my teammates, you know, that went along with me, you know, through the years. And I'm really excited about receiving this, and I will give all my thanks, you know, to all the people that make this day so possible for me, you know. I'm sorry you have to excuse my English, but I'm trying."
One guy who didn't have any trouble with his English was Edward Bennett Williams, the prominent Washington attorney, who is also the president of the Washington Redskins. Williams was there to present an award to Joe DiMaggio, and he let you know right away how he felt about that.
"Every sports fan is entitled to have one living hero. Mine always has been and is Joe DiMaggio. And that's my only qualification to be up here making this presentation tonight. I heard during the cocktail hour that the dinner committee was badly divided on my selection to make this award. Half of them thought that this very special and unique award would be made by someone who had made himself a great contribution to baseball, not someone identified with the Redskins. I felt bad when I heard this, because watching our last three games, I got the impression that we were making the greatest contribution to baseball in Washington. Since Walter Johnson.
The Washington Baseball Writers' Dinner was usual in only one way. They presented an award to Carl Yastrzemski. But they even managed to do that differently, because the man who handed him the award was Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy.
Believe me, he's still the biggest celebrity in Massachusetts. As a matter of fact, with a name like Carl Yastrzemski, I'd run for public office. Despite Carl's outstanding personal abilities, he never tried to overshadow the club. The pennant run was a real team effort, and Carl is a team player all the way. Carl's not originally a Massachusetts boy. He comes from Long Island, New York. And although the Boston Red Sox have made some great trades, like the deal they brought Jerry Adair from Chicago and the one that brought Gary Bell from Cleveland, the greatest of all time came when Massachusetts traded Bobby Kennedy to New York for Carl Yastrzemski.
For Yastrzemski, this was the topping on a wonderful day. In the company of his wife and his parents, Carl had lunch with the congressional delegation from Massachusetts. And later they visited with President Johnson at the White House. Carl Yastrzemski was really the conquering hero. But in the course of his speech, he told that audience, as he had told the president earlier, of his own feelings about heroes.
I'll never forget attending the Boston Naval Hospital after the Battle of Dick Moran. We had a lot of veterans wounded. I can remember coming up to this one youngster and trying to make him feel relaxed and happy and useful. And I told him, I said, the youth of America today is all with the country, and that just a small minority is against the country. And these are the ones that grab the headlines in the papers. And as I proceeded to go on and on, he interrupted me. He said, Mr. Yastrzemski. And this fellow was hit by shrapnel, and he's immobile for 6 months with a cast up to his neck, and he can't move until July 1st. The reason I'm over in Vietnam and the reason I was wounded is because that these people may demonstrate and express their own feeling, their true feelings, and that democracy prevails in the United States. These are the great, courageous people of today, the Vietnam boys. And believe me, all the awards that I receive, I appreciate. But the most gracious awards I receive is from a lot of the hospitals. These Vietnam boys, after I visit them, they send a little letter, and each Vietnam soldier autographs it. This is the kind of trophy I like to hang in my house, because they're a great inspiration to me.
I'll be back with more highlights from the Washington, D.C. Baseball Writers' Dinner, so stay right here on the Monitor Beacon.
Now, back to Joe Garagiola.
Last Tuesday's Washington Baseball Writers' Dinner was an unusual sports banquet in a lot of ways, including the fact that one of the speakers was Mrs. Liz Carpenter, press secretary to Mrs. Lyndon Johnson. Mrs. Carpenter proved that she could pitch in the banquet league, any banquet league. She had a good fastball, an excellent change of pace, and she showed that she knew how to throw a pretty good brushback pitch. Here's the way she started.
Mr. Vice President, Senator Kennedy, and fellow baseball fans, I've come here tonight to talk about baseball. Why, you ask? Because it's 1968, and we have a policy to go anywhere, anytime, any place. To discuss any subject with anybody. Besides, I heard that Carl Yastrzemski was going to be here, and everyone at the White House has been ordered to find a good pole. Actually, I truly am an ardent sports fan. But in the sports I know, I follow no particular field or season. You know the league I play in, weddings, tree plantings, births, hand-to-hand combat at ladies' luncheons. The only diamonds I ever see are on some girl's hand. And for me to talk about baseball was a little like asking George Romney to discuss bowling or politics. Mr. Vice President, looking ahead and scouting the Elephant Club, I really see no cause for alarm. Their dugout is filled with rookies, 200 hitters, chokers, and sore-arm pitchers. Just take a look at the lineup. Batting leadoff is that Detroit Tiger. He's the player with the cleanest brain in the league. He's tripped on the dugout steps, gotten hit by a bad pitch, walked to third base, and is now stumbling around in left field. Next in the batting order of the Elephant Club, there's that tricky old veteran Dodger who left California and came to New York. He plays any position, hits to all fields, and hopes to improve his batting average, which at present is zero. And then there's the California Angel. A real rookie who plays right but thinks he's in center. And don't forget the New York Yankee, a holdout who couldn't get to first base last season and now hopes to steal home before anyone realizes he's in the game. Last, there are the Minnesota Twins, Stassen and McCarthy, and a wild pitch specialist from Alabama who hopes they'll allow three teams in the World Series. But there's one thing that you can say for both sports, politics and baseball. If you want to win the ball game, you can't spend your time warming the bench. And that reminds me of an epitaph I read chiseled on an old tombstone in Bruton Parish Churchyard. Here lie the bones of Lucy Jones. For her, life held no terrors. Aloof she lived, aloof she died. No hits, no runs, no errors.
Just as Carl Yastrzemski was stepping to the microphone, the vice president arrived. And as you'll hear, he got a particular kick out of interrupting Yaz. A little later, I was handed a note telling me to announce that Mrs. Humphrey was present. The vice president leaned over to tell me that his wife wasn't there. And while he was telling me, up stepped Mrs. Humphrey. I think you'll enjoy hearing how the vice president handled these matters, as well as some others, during this talk.
Thank you very much, Joe. Senator Kennedy, Joe DiMaggio, and that twin wrecker, Carl Yastrzemski. I'll tell you, I don't mind interrupting you when I come in. After all, you interrupted me up in Boston. I haven't forgotten it. By the way, Mrs. Humphrey, it's very nice to see you tonight. I'm glad that you're here. We've been out, we've had a triple header tonight, not a double header. We have to settle for even higher odds, starting out with the county officials, over with the corporate directors and plans for progress, and finally getting around where I can talk about something that I don't know anything about tonight. And those are my best speeches. I thought I ought to speak for the opposition after Liz Carpenter has held the floor here. After all, the vice president, vice presidency has never been considered to be exactly the choice office of the country, and I've just resolved to make it nonpartisan. I'll run on either ticket. I feel sort of like the village mortician following Bob Hope after listening to Liz's non-political speech. I know that this was cleared at the White House because I heard him going over the lines over there a little bit earlier. And I'll give a good report back that you came up here and bravely recited every word that the president wrote for you. I'm going to talk about baseball because I talk about it a great deal. I'm a red-hot sports fan, baseball fan. I even got on the radio out home and tried to broadcast a game or two, which brought me nothing but trouble. But I did it anyway. I think I should qualify myself, though. I'm Washington's leading pinch hitter. Whenever the star isn't around, they throw old Humphrey in there to do a little hitting. And I'm very honored tonight not only to get my cuts in, which I intend to, but to be in such illustrious company. To be with that inventor of Yogi Berra, Joe Gargiola here, he invented that. With the leading character in George Selkirk's Greatest Trade, Mike McCormick. And with Big John Wyatt's favorite manager, Dick Williams. And with the best all-around player in the American League next to Cesar Tovar, Carl Yastrzemski. Carl, I didn't cast that one vote. I swear I didn't. And with the best high hurdler out of Texas since Babe Didrikson, Liz Carpenter. And with that living symbol of the Alliance for Progress, Paul Casanova. And finally, I'm very honored to be with the greatest of them all, a man who's covered more ground in his time than Johnson, Humphrey, and Dean Russ put together, Joe DiMaggio. Now, some of you may wonder why I was late. Well, I've been waiting out in the lobby for Eddie Stanky. But he still hasn't shown up. Now, actually, though, I want to get on the record here. I really don't bear any grudge against Eddie for locking me out of his dressing room last summer. I've lost a few myself. But I do resent his statement. His statement to the Chicago Press when he said, Humphrey can't hit. That got me. And I will admit, when I first came up to the farm system, I was a free swinger who often didn't connect. But in these past 3 years, with some intense coaching, I've not only mastered the hit and run, but am without a doubt the unchallenged master of the sacrifice. And for you Republicans, I go to the right now just as easy as I used to go to the left. Now I want to have another word about my friend Eddie Stanky. I just want to warn him that he crossed the wrong men last summer. First, he blasted you, Carl. Carl Yastrzemski, he took the first blow. Then, of course, he just took on Humphrey just to keep in practice. But right now, in light of what happened with you, Carl, I'm trying to get Eddie to insult the president. Now, it's little known, but I had one of the best one-loss seasons records in the American League last year. In fact, I went into that final weekend series up there at Boston with a 6-1 record. I'd watched the Twins 7 times, and they'd won 6. Then I got to Boston. It was just like when I went to West Virginia in 1960. Kennedy's to the right of me. Kennedy's to the left of me. Yastrzemski all over me. Humphrey in the middle. And there went Minnesota's lead right out of the ballpark.
So there you have it. I thought that this was a dinner that you'd enjoy as much as I did. And I certainly want to thank Maury Siegel, the dinner chairman, for his cooperation in making it possible for you to hear it. I'd also like to thank the speakers you've heard this evening for making it such a great party. This is Joe Garagiola for Monitor Sports.
That was another Monitor special. Highlights from the first annual dinner given by the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Baseball Writers Association of America. And as Joe said, one of the most unusual sports dinners ever held. Monitor, the What's Happening sound of the weekend world, available on NBC stations across the nation. In Cadillac, Michigan, WATT serves the Cadillac area Four Seasons Vacation Land. Brad Crandall reminding you that Monitor continues after a few words from your local station.
The ambassador from the Ponderosa, Mr. Lorne Green, visits Monitor shortly on the NBC Radio Network. Patrick McGowan provides the action. Dave Brubeck provides the jazz. Watch all night long on the Sunday Film Festival tonight at 11:30.
That's tonight at 11:30 on Channel 4, New York. It is 36 degrees and cloudy in Midtown Manhattan. This is the Conversation Station, WNBC, New York. 8:30. Monitor 68, your host, Brad Crandall, bringing you this unusual bit of information. The fastest elevators in the world are in the RCA building in New York and the Prudential building in Chicago. Don't know what good that'll do you, but I thought you might get a lift out of it. A new one by Les and Larry Elgar now, Lady. Monitor music from Ed Ames. Who will answer?
From the canyons of the mind, we wander on and stumble blindly through the often tangled maze of starless nights and sunless days, while asking for some kind of clue or road to lead us to the truth. But who will answer? Side by side, two people stand together, bound hand in hand, that love's embedded in their hearts. But soon an empty feeling starts to overwhelm their hollow lives. And when they seek the hows and whys, who will answer? On a strange and distant hill, a young man lying very still. His arms will never hold his child, because a bullet running wild has struck him down. And now we cry, dear God, oh why, but who will answer? High upon a lonely ledge, a figure teeters near the edge, and jeering crowds collect below to egg him on with go, man, go. But who will ask what led him to his private day of doom? And who will answer? If the soul is darkened, I appear it cannot name. If the mind is baffled, it's the game. Who will answer? Who will answer? Who will answer? country, the world revolves in apathy. As overhead a row of specks roars on, drowned out by discotheques. And if a secret button's pressed, because one man has been outguessed, who will answer? Is our hope in walnut shells worn round the neck with temple bells? Or deep within some cloistered walls, where hooded figures pray in halls? Or from old books and dusty shelves? Or in our stars or in ourselves?
Goes with you wherever you go over the weekend. It's a good way to stay in the know while you're on the go. And if you're driving, might be a good idea to check your seatbelts, huh? Brad Crandall here. In about 2 minutes, some very amusing stories about entertaining in the White House from author Marie Smith. The Johnny Man Singers get us in the mood now with Instant Happy.
Where have I been all your life? Oh, yeah. I bet you thought you'd never find me.
Entertaining in the White House, author Marie Smith has compiled historic documentary proof that funny things happen to people everywhere, even in the White House. Well, like the time President Kennedy was faced with an inebriated guest of honor at a state dinner. What happened? Well, Betty Grobley gets the story from the author in this Monitor interview.
Marie, what were the circumstances in the first instance with the intoxicated guest? Betty, it happened during President Kennedy's administration. The guest had apparently had something to drink before he went to the White House, and after drinking the fine wines they serve at a state dinner at the White House, he became inebriated. President Kennedy saw what was happening, and he cut the dinner short. He took the guest downstairs to the library, away from the rest of the guests, so they would not see him in this condition, and he was just about to present him a copy of his book, Profiles in Courage, when just as he held the book out, the guest of honor
passed out
cold is the word, yes.
And what about the chair breaker?
Oh, well, this was another guest, and this happened not too long ago during the Johnson administration. It was a man, a big, big man from that big, big state, and you know which one I'm talking mm-hmm. about. And apparently it was his first dinner at the White House. During the dinner, he was talking with great animation, waving his hands and arms. The lady sitting next to him was wearing a brand new white satin dress, and just as she lifted her wine glass, he waved his arm and hit the glass, knocking it and the wine onto her beautiful dress. Of course, the butlers are always standing in the wings for such emergencies or anything else, so he came rushing out very quietly with a napkin and mopped the lady up and tried to make things right, and in no more than turned his back when the big gentleman leaned back in his dainty little gold chair, and it crashed to the floor. The butler came back with a little broom, swept up the splinters, brought another chair for the gentleman, and he continued at dinner as if nothing had happened. And then after dinner, when all the guests went to the East Room for the entertainment, he took a chair on the front row right with the president and the guest of honor. And during the middle of the entertainment, he apparently became bored, and he leaned back in the little chair again, and a second time the chair went crumbling beneath him. But I don't think anyone had more fun that night at the White House than he did.
You also mentioned that we've been having some curious problems with Cuba, which started on the entertaining level way back in 1927. Is this when Calvin Coolidge was
in? Oh, yes, Betty. I think more things happened at that state dinner President Coolidge gave for the president of Cuba than at any other state dinner in the history of the White House. Number one of the high-ranking American guests broke his front tooth while he was eating. Number two, one of the high-ranking Cuban guests lost his necktie sometime during the evening and only discovered it at the table. And it was one of these neckties that you hook, and it became unhooked, and he did a little bow tie. Yes, that's right. And
what did he do?
He kept his hand to his neck throughout the dinner and ate with the other hand. And then one of the Cuban guests, who was a very large man, went through the bottom of his chair during the dinner, but he apparently was unaware of it, because when he stood up to leave the table, he started walking off with the chair hanging behind him. All the time, the White House was on fire, and firemen were racing around on the roof and on second floor trying to battle a blaze that was in the chimney. But the guests were unaware of that. They had enough excitement of their own.
And you say that some of the inhabitants of the White House had delusions of grandeur. Who were they?
Oh, yes. Angelica Van Buren felt apparently that she was a queen because she received guests seated
on
his throne. She was Martin Van Buren's daughter-in-law, who served as his hostess or first lady during his administration after she married his son. And she received seated in a chair as if on a throne where the guests could come by and stare or smile, and if she felt like smiling or speaking, she did. If not, she sat there with a queenly look, and the guests walked on by. And of course, Dolly Madison, everyone talks about, and did then, and they still do, Dolly reigning as a queen. However, Dolly was really a very warm, friendly person. It was just that she had the queenly bearing, and she would walk through a crowded reception room with her head high, with a big white turban on top of her dark hair and ostrich feathers hanging down in her face. And when Dolly would come into a room, she would carry a book in her hand. It was not that she read a lot, but Dolly carried the book as a conversation opener so that people, if she couldn't think of anything else to say, she would ask a guest, have you read this book?
Not a bad idea.
No, it isn't.
You can read about this in Entertaining in the White House by my guest, Marie Smith, who has been entertained in the White House. This is Betty Grobley for Monitor.
Monitor music now, a change in mood. This plaintive plea from the big voice of Jerry Vale. Don't tell my heart to stop loving you.
Tell me now,
don't you just walk away? Say our love's part of your past. Tell me to stay, not another day. I should have known it would never last.
Continues with this wedding announcement from Manila. Juan Nacida, 121 years old, was married this week to Elisa Regala, 56. Juan walked briskly and without a cane to exchange vows with his bride in a civil ceremony, which only goes to prove that you're as young as you feel. You want to know a good way to feel young? Well, just
eat to do money.
Good advice, a lot of good music, and a report on sportive speed about to come your way. So stay on the Monitor Beacon. Monitor continues. Brad Crandall here, 12 minutes before the hour. And this timely observation by Edie Gourmet. Life's but a moment.
You're young, little girl. So sing, little girl, for the world is yours today. Life is but a moment, but in that moment you can live a lifetime filled with happiness and laughter. Don't let that golden moment slip away.
Now, Sportive Speed, today's news, views, and results from the number one spectator sport in America, auto racing. Chris Economaki reporting.
Joe Garson of Eagle Rock, California, was an all-the-way winner Thursday night as three-quarter midget racing began a 14-week stand at Southern California's newest sports palace, the Forum in Englewood. Joe is living proof that life begins at 40. A veteran of 37 years behind the wheel, the former Eastern driving star recently celebrated his 59th birthday. Taking advantage of a late-race pit stop by Scotsman Jim Clark, New Zealander Bruce McLaren drove his BRM to victory in Saturday's Tauranga Grand Prix at Invercargill, New Zealand. Clark, last week's winner in Christchurch, had to be satisfied with second place with his Lotus Ford. Australian Frank Gardner took third in his surprisingly fast Brabham Alfa Romeo. Winner of the first two events on the Tasman Series and current point leader, Chris Amon of New Zealand, was fourth in his V6 Ferrari ahead of Britain's Piers Courage and the new world champion, Denny Holm of New Zealand. England's Vic Elford has won the week-long Monte Carlo Rally for Porsche and now heads for Daytona Beach as one of their team drivers in next weekend's 24 Hours of Daytona. The country's longest endurance race yesterday received a surprise entry of a factory-prepared Ferrari prototype to be driven by Mexico's Pedro Rodriguez and Jean Guichet of France. And there was United States Auto Club midget action indoors in Indiana and outdoors in California this afternoon. At the Allen County Coliseum in Fort Wayne, Bob McLean, a veteran from South Bend, took the 100-lap Roadie Memorial and with it the title of indoor champion. Bobby Grimm was second, with national champion Mel Kenyon third, as John Tenney and Bill Campbell rounded out the top five. Promoter Bill Lipke was all smiles as 4,662 fans turned out for the Midwest's final indoor event of the winter. And at the River Grade Speedway in Irwindale, California, Bert Poland of Hayward, California, took this afternoon's 40-lap main event, with Billy Vukovich finishing second after leading most of the way, tire trouble forcing his car to slow. Former Easterner Chuck Arnold was third, with Gary Bettenhausen fourth. USAC Sprints hit the new River Grade half-miler next on Sunday afternoon, the 11th of February. But the big race of the weekend, today's 250-mile USAC late-model stock car road race in Phoenix, Arizona, was a heartbreaker for Al Unser. Leading with three laps to go, a fan blade broke on his Dodge Charger, knocking off its water pump, and allowing fellow Dodge driver Don White of Keokuk, Iowa, to take the victory. David Pearson, visiting from NASCAR with his 68 Ford Torino, took second, and Jack Bowser in a Ford Fairlane was third. Roger McCluskey drove Norm Nelson's Plymouth into fourth place, with A.J. Foyt, the fifth place finisher, in a Ford Torino. The early leader, Parnelli Jones, went out near the halfway mark with a blown engine on his Ford. And this is Chris Economaki for Monitor Sports.
Sport of Speed with Chris Economaki, leading authority on auto racing, is a regular Saturday and Sunday feature on Monitor. Two more Monitor regulars now, Sandler and Young, in the Sunshine Days.
Life was so good in the sunshine days. Why was I restless at all?
Beginning Saturday, February 3rd, NBC Radio begins covering the 10th Winter Olympics from Grenoble, France. 33 nations and over 2,300 of the world's finest amateur athletes will be competing for honors in this most famous and spectacular of all sporting events. Jim Simpson, Len Dillon, and Jay Miller will take you to a front row seat for what promises to be the greatest of all Winter Olympic Games. The 10th Winter Olympics, beginning February 3rd on Monitor. Don't miss it. Happy Feeling by Vincent Bell and the Electric Sitar. News on the hour coming up next, followed by more music and a visit to the Ponderosa with Lauren Green. Brad Crandall inviting you to...
Please, the latest news now is on the air. Please, the latest news now is on the air.
I'm Jenny Kay, executive secretary and recovered alcoholic. I had a serious drinking problem. My life was a mess. I was a girl who was going to work hard and really make it big. Well, I did work hard, but I couldn't seem to make it at all. I juggled charge accounts, forgot to eat, overslept, didn't go to work, lied, cheated, and slowly died inside. In short, I was a zombie, unemployable, undesirable, and very, very sick. I thought I was some kind of nut, and that alcohol was the only thing that made life bearable. But I learned through Alcoholics Anonymous that alcohol was my real problem, and AA showed me that I could do something about it.
If you or someone close to you is having a drinking problem, the number to call for information is code 212-Oregon-9-3355. That's code 212-Oregon-9-3355.
Lee Leonard invites you to Radio Premiere Week, tomorrow on WNBC New York. It's now 9 o'clock.